Okay, so we're going to start part two here. I just want to make a few concluding thoughts about the very early church, and then we're going to fast forward about 1,000 years to the Reformation. So, just a few highlights, as you can see on the screen. We're used to thinking of the persecution primarily in the first century, but actually, the greatest persecutions of the church were in the third and fourth century. There was the mid third century under Decius and Diocletian. And this where bishops in nearly every church across the entire Christianity were arrested, put in jail, many, many hundreds and even thousands killed. And that was the persecution that led to the formation of this Novatian sect, where we had this discussion over discipleship. And then the second massive persecution against the church was in the very early fourth century, under Diocletian and Galerian. And in this one, tens of thousands of Christians were killed in the arena. It was just a horrible situation. And this led to a further split over discipleship, over the issue of if somebody has basically disowned Christianity, can they be a priest? Of course, we don't have priests, but and they decided at that point that, the holiness is found in the church, not in the individual. And that's a development of sacramentalism. But anyway, then the big event in the early church, of course, was the Edict of Toleration in 313 AD. And then, of course, Constantine was a pseudo-Christian emperor. That's when the Council of Nicaea happened. And the church in the fourth century were so fired up. They thought this is the greatest thing that ever happened to Christianity. Christianity is legal. We're not going to be persecuted. And it was perhaps the worst disaster that ever came on the church. Because what happened is millions, literally millions of people who weren't even disciples flood into the church because the church had tax advantages. And really, it destroyed discipleship. So that by the fifth century, we have Augustine, he's complaining because almost no one in his church is even really a disciple of Jesus. And that's partly explains why you got monks in asceticism, because people decided to be a Christian, you have to leave the church. So what they thought at the time was the greatest victory of all, in many ways, was an utter disaster for the church. I have to, before I talk about the Reformation, I have to talk about Augustine just a little bit. Augustine, the greatest theologian in the history of Christianity, probably from Paul all the way to modern times. And he virtually created Christianity in the West, what we call Catholic Christianity, and the Christianity of the Middle Ages. He was a brilliant man, a great writer, but he solidified sort of what we think of as Catholic Christianity. He got hung up on the sovereignty of God. And one of the things we're going to learn from Augustine, from Calvin, from Luther, from Zwingli is if we pick one of God's traits and focus laser on that trait to the exclusion of others, we become really messed up. God is holy. God is love. God is sovereign. God is just. And all these traits are, I don't know if I can say equal, but they're all very, very important. So during the Reformation and during the time of Augustine, it seemed like God's sovereignty trumped all other of his aspects. So that led to the idea of essentially predestination. And it's a little bit complicated because there were other factors going on. But what they were doing is they were baptizing babies. Well, why are we baptizing babies if salvation is by faith? Well, then, oh, I know why, because of original sin. And so Augustine did not create the doctrine of original sin or of total depravity, but he's the one who kind of put it in concrete. And this is the idea that we inherit the sin of Adam almost genetically. And also that we're totally depraved, so that basically salvation has nothing to do with us and everything with God. And so basically, Augustine taught that free will is really an illusion. And he also basically preached very, very strongly that state and church should be joined together in what I would call an unholy alliance. Because The state was defending the church militarily, and the church was supporting the state. And basically, under those circumstances, that means everybody is a Christian. But you and I both know that everybody's not a Christian. And so what happened is we got what we call Christendom, which is this unholy marriage between the state and the religion. A lot of Americans really want to have school prayer and, you know, and kind of all this sort of stuff. But I'm telling you, is that something you really want? Because I believe politics and Christianity really have very little to do with one another. Also, he taught transubstantiation and the idea that the bread and the wine are literally transformed through sort of abracadabra thing they would do with the Eucharist into the actual bread and body of Jesus, and the idea that the communion is a sacrifice, a reenactment of the sacrifice of Christ, and so many of these things really were corrosive to biblical Christianity. The opponent of Augustine was Pelagius. Pelagius taught that we are responsible for being holy. And it's not just ex opere operato. In other words, the actual act, the Christian act of baptism or the act of priesthood and these sacraments, that alone gave the grace of salvation. He says, no, we need to be holy. We're responsible for living like Christ. And he taught free will. And so Pelagius became sort of the enemy of Western Christianity, because he taught free will and he denied predestination. And if you're ever accused of being a Pelagian, maybe you are. I don't know. I wish I had time to talk about Christianity in the Middle Ages, because in all ages there were true Christians. I'm telling you, the numbers were very small. The Pelagians in Asia Minor, literally hundreds of thousands of them martyred for the faith. And the Albigenses in southern France, and the Inquisition was created basically to destroy this group of Christians who were trying to reestablish biblical Christianity and get rid of the priesthood and the papacy and the Waldensians and many other groups. But I'm going to talk about the Reformation a little bit. I don't have a lot of time, but I really need to introduce the Reformation. And now, here's the deal. Remember, we had orthopraxy, heteropraxy, orthodoxy, heterodoxy. Now, the Catholic Church, is its problem heterodoxy or heteropraxy? Bad theology or bad practice? The answer is bad practice. I believe that the Catholic Church today probably has more biblical theology than most Protestants. And we got to find out why. All right, and so, anyway, as far as practice of Christianity, the Catholic Church was and is a total disaster. You have indulgences and purgatory and basically work salvation. It was a disaster. So somebody had to do something about that. So I wish I had time to talk about John Wycliffe, such a hero of Christianity. He taught Scripture is the only authority. He was the first one to translate the Bible into English. Unfortunately, it was from the Vulgate Latin, so it wasn't a very good translation. He opposed idolatry and indulgences and purgatory. He called the Pope the Antichrist. Whew. All right. His followers were known as the Lollards, and they were persecuted, but England at that time was kind of in a rebellion against Rome. So believe it or not, John Wycliffe died in his 60s, in his bed of natural causes. But that was in 1384. But in 1401, his group was pronounced a heresy. In 1415, at the Council of Constantine, he was pronounced a heretic. And in 1438, they dug up his bones, burned them, and threw the ashes into the River Swift. And so basically that movement to get back to biblical Christianity was nearly wiped out by the Catholic Church. And then in Bohemia, there's John Wycliffe. And then in Bohemia, you have the Hussites, John Huss. who was really, in some ways, the disciple of John Wycliffe. In Bohemia, he was in Prague. He taught that the Bible is the only authority for truth. Only God can forgive sin. It removed the idea of a priest having this sacrament of confession. He rejected veneration of saints and idols. And he basically taught that we need to teach people the Bible in their own native language. And he tried to reform the Catholic Church. He wasn't trying to form a new church. He was trying to reform the Catholic Church. So what happened is at the Council of Constance, he was given free, safe passage to that council. Instead, they arrested him and they burned him at the stake. In fact, and then over the next 20 years, tens of thousands of brothers and sisters trying to reestablish biblical Christianity outside of the Catholic hierarchy were killed. And believe it or not, his movement was not completely destroyed, because from that movement we got the Brethren, a fairly small group, and the Moravian Church, which was a really influential on the Restoration movement. But really, the first successful Reformation, basically these Reformations were unsuccessful in that they were almost completely suppressed. The bottom line is, you had to have a political support for your church. Christendom was not ended by the Reformation. So what happened was you needed a reformer who was going to have a king or a prince who was going to politically support that reform. First person to do that was Martin Luther. We all know about Martin Luther. Martin Luther is a hero of the faith in so many ways, but there's a few significant problems there. Now, Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk. Who's that remind you? Oh, Augustine. So really, what Martin Luther did was he did not return Christianity to primitive theology and teaching. He returned Catholic Christianity to Augustine. I didn't mention that during the Middle Ages, you had Thomas Aquinas, who actually began to teach that we actually do have free will and that God works with us in our salvation. So that the Catholic Church today doesn't completely buy Augustine and his complete monergism, which is that it's all of God and none of us. And I believe the Catholic Church, although there's some interesting work salvation stuff, their basic concept of how we're saved is actually pretty close. So Martin Luther basically took Christianity back to Augustine, which is not a great place to take it. Anyway, he was a monk, and he was beginning to teach the Bible there in Wittenberg and teaching Greek, and he put the famous 95 Theses against indulgences. Indulgences were basically what you do is they had this idea of purgatory, and basically baptism took care of the sins that were committed by Adam, but not your sins. So the sins that you commit have to be taken care of by maybe going on a trip to Jerusalem, or by doing enough masses in your honor or whatever, but also by paying indulgences. Basically, X dollars gets you X number of years out of purgatory. And purgatory mainly was about doing things not to get yourself out of purgatory, is to get your parents and your brothers and sisters. And there was this whole monetary system developed. And the money was used to build up like St. Peter's in Rome. It was a horrible system, so he opposed that. He was not trying to get rid of the Catholic Church, but to reform it. But unfortunately for him, when he published those theses, within a few weeks they were published all over Germany, and it started a revolution, which he couldn't stop. Now, Martin Luther did a couple of really great things. One thing he did was he studied Romans. And he discovered that salvation is by faith. That's the theme of Romans. All right, but he kind of went too far, you know, the whole pendulum swinging thing. Anyway, and the other great thing he did was he translated the Bible into German. One of the very first highly successful Bibles in the native language. And he was a great scholar, incredible scholar. So he taught the Bible only, Sound good? Sounds good. He taught grace only, not works. Great. And he taught faith only. And there's the problem. In fact, in Romans 3:28, where it says salvation by faith, he literally added the word alone there. He just added it in there. He was so caught up in faith alone. And this faith alone teaching is the hallmark teaching of the entire Protestant Reformation. It characterizes the Protestant Reformation more than any single thing. Salvation by faith alone. And therefore, we have predestination and things happen to the doctrine of baptism eventually. All right. And so he called the book of James a book of straw. He literally wanted to remove it from the Bible. Later on, he changed his tune on that, but that kind of shows where he's going. He was very, very, very strong on predestination, the sovereignty of God, because after all, he is Augustinian. And unlike Zwingli and Calvin, as we'll see, Luther kept quite a bit of the sort of backdrop of Catholicism. Like the ministers still wear robes. They still had a church calendar. So if you look at Lutheranism today, you think, wow, that's an awful lot like Catholicism. Except, of course, they have faith only and all the basic Protestant teachings. Well, there's reason for that, because that goes back to Martin Luther. More important to understanding Christianity today is not Martin Luther. It's Ulrich Zwingli. Ulrich Zwingli, who created what is commonly called Reformed theology. And Reformed theology is the basic theology of Presbyterianism, of Anglicanism, of Dutch Reform, of most Charismatics, most Baptists. In fact, basically, most Protestant Christianity is Reformed. It goes back to the theology of Ulrich Zwingli and John Calvin. So if you want to understand Christianity as it's practiced in America today, you have to understand what happened, not so much with Martin Luther, but with Ulrich Zwingli and John Calvin. So we have to spend a little bit of time thinking about Ulrich Zwingli, a Swiss reformer. He was there in Zurich. He was more radical in his Reformation. Actually, his Reformation was more gradual. It occurred over 10 years rather than Martin Luther's, whose Reformation was in a period of about 3 or 4 years. But gradually he went beyond Luther. He rejected almost all Catholic practice. And Christianity in Switzerland was known as four bare walls and a sermon. So he took all the statues out, all the stained glass. And they had no musical instruments. And it was basically preaching, Lord's Supper, done. That was pretty much it. He was even stronger on predestination, even than Martin Luther. And basically, he taught what's called double predestination. And basically, he said that God is glorified as much by those who go to hell as he is by those who go to heaven. And he stole free will completely. And complete monergism, which means all the energy in salvation comes from God and nothing from us at all. And again, so he was Augustinian in many ways. He and Martin Luther disagreed on very few doctrines, actually. But one of them was the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. Martin Luther, I'm going to say he believed in transubstantiation. That's actually not completely correct. He believed it didn't literally transform into the actual blood and bread, but it was spiritually transformed, although not physically transformed. And Ulrich Zwingli believed that basically it was just the Lord's Supper was a remembrance. So, Jesus says, eat, this is my body. And there's a famous meeting where the two met. And basically Martin Luther put a line in the sand. He says, hey, God, Jesus says, eat, this is my body. I believe it. And Ulrich Zwingli said, no, what it means is this is like my body. Now, we agree with Ulrich Zwingli, don't we? Yes. Our doctrine of the Lord's Supper is that of Ulrich Zwingli. And really, as far as I know, he's the first person to teach that. All right, now, but, you know, it's worth asking, might there be something, you know, might there be some spiritual participation of the Holy Spirit in this Lord's Supper rather than merely a remembrance? Something to think about. Maybe Martin Luther wasn't completely wrong, but either way, they refused to cooperate and they pronounced each other heretics, a disaster for the Protestant movement. Very important to note, again, most of the Christianity that's practiced today comes directly from Zwingli and Calvin. And he made a very important point here, which is a problem, which is he said baptism is merely a symbol. Basically, what Zwingli said is baptism is to Christianity what circumcision is to Judaism. And therefore, baptism is merely a symbol of what God has already done. And you could argue that is essentially what circumcision is. And it's worth noting that the New Testament does make a connection between circumcision and baptism. For example, in Colossians chapter 2. But basically, Ulrich Zwingli was the first person in history to teach that baptism is an act which is a symbol of something that God has already done. Well, there you go. So where did that come from? Ulrich Zwingli. So when you have a discussion with somebody about that, you can say that doctrine didn't even exist until the 16th century. There's no record of anybody teaching baptism is merely a symbol. All right, so that's worth noting. Another thing is we'll talk about the Anabaptists in a minute, and the Anabaptist movement came from Zwingli's movement. The Anabaptist movement, this was a large movement in the 16th and 17th century of our brothers and sisters, essentially. We'll learn about them. And initially, Zwingli agreed with them. There's this famous meeting. It occurred in like 1524, in which everybody in the room, including Zwingli, agreed that faith is essential to salvation and faith is required for baptism. And therefore, only an adult could be baptized. And Zwingli agreed, but he went home and I don't know what happened, but I think it's this. Zwingli wanted to hang on to Christendom. And Christendom means the state and the church are joined in what I call an unholy alliance. And basically, baptism was citizenship. And so if he acknowledged that only disciples can be baptized, that means, oh, wait a minute, so who's a citizen then? And he believed this would bring chaos into the political system, which is probably true. So he went for Christendom, and he basically threw away the doctrine of baptism having any connection. Even Martin Luther believed that salvation occurred at baptism. But Zwingli rejected that idea. And that was a disaster. Because really, that's Protestant Christianity right there. Kind of went down the tubes there. Zwingli said, sacraments are signs or ceremonies by which men offer themselves before the church as soldiers or disciples of Christ. And he completely rejected the idea of baptismal regeneration, that baptism actually does anything to us. It's merely a symbol. By the way, it's interesting to note that Zwingli died with a sword in his hand, fighting a battle, trying to defend Zurich against Catholic troops that were trying to conquer them. All right, let me talk about the Anabaptist movement. It's tempting to do John Calvin first, but I want to talk about the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists, this developed right there out of from Swiss, in the Swiss Reformation. And these people were basically our brothers and sisters. It's also called the Radical Reformation. Basically, Anabaptist means rebaptizers. Of course, they didn't believe in rebaptism because they believed the only real baptism is that of a disciple of Jesus who's made a commitment, has repented of their sins, and made a decision to follow Jesus. Then we baptize them by immersion. Now, their connection of that with forgiveness of sins was maybe not quite as solid as ours. They taught immersion of adults after confession and repentance. They taught the Bible is the only authority for truth. They were very solid on separation of church and state. Basically, they completely rejected Christendom altogether. They taught that the church is made up of true believers and true believers, disciples only. They taught that a free will is required, that our decision and our attempts to be holy is required in order to be saved. They were pacifists. They completely reject any involvement in the government or even being a soldier at all. They taught kind of a prevenient grace. I'll talk about that in a minute. And they were restorationists. In other words, their philosophy was, we're going to completely turn away from anything that's happened in the past. We're trying to reestablish primitive Christianity, which is basically what the Restoration Movement is, and really is, in a sense, our background. One of the things about the Anabaptists is that they were very schismatic. When we try to restore the exact new Christianity of the New Testament, one of the most difficult things is to maintain unity. Because the restorationist idea is to restore the things of the Bible, but the question is, what are the essential things? All restorationists believe we restore only the essential things. But here's the question, what's essential? That is a lesson of church history. Oops, I've only got a minute or so to go here. I better move on. But anyway, the Anabaptists were viciously persecuted by Calvinists, by the Zwinglians, by the Lutherans. Luther didn't want to. He was more gentle. And basically what the Zwinglians would do, they say, you want to get baptized again? They tie a rope around them and a rock and throw them into the lake and drown them. And virtually every single person who was baptized into the Anabaptist church was martyred. All the early leaders were killed within just a few months. In fact, baptism in the Anabaptist church was essentially preparation for martyrdom. All right. Anyway, these were our brothers and sisters. Baptism by immersion, Bible the only authority. Initially, they were extremely evangelistic, but they were so horribly persecuted. Within 50 years, they basically pulled back and they formed their own communities and they stopped reaching out. And they became the Mennonites, the Amish. We still have Anabaptist groups today, but they almost completely lost their ability to affect the world. Mistake City, but I'm not going to judge them because I'm telling you, it was do that or die. Michael Sattler said, true believing Christians are sheep among wolves, sheep for the slaughter. They must be baptized in anxiety, distress, affliction, persecution, suffering, and death. They employ neither worldly sword nor war, since with them, killing is absolutely renounced. Awesome stuff. John Calvin. Oh, I can't talk about John Calvin. The bottom line is John Calvin, the most influential theologian after Augustine, before modern times. And really, ultimately, the Baptist Church, the Presbyterian Church, and Christianity comes from Zwingli and John Calvin. Probably the greatest commentator of the Bible in all history, an amazing scholar. He wrote the Institutes of Christian Religion, which essentially became sort of the constitution of Protestantism. He developed the idea of TULIP, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, perseverance of the saints, once saved, always saved. These are the basic tenets of all Protestantism, virtually. And it explains why people believe in once saved, always saved, which makes absolutely no sense. Why would you believe in that? Because you believe in total depravity. And if you believe in total depravity, you believe that only there's a limited atonement, which is a damnable sin, in my opinion. And therefore, grace has to be irresistible. And therefore, once saved, always saved. And that's the basics of Protestant Christianity. Arminius, Jacob Arminius, who was a Dutch reformer, he tried to throw out this radical Calvinism and reestablish the idea of prevenient grace, which grace is a gift, yes, but it's a gift in which we participate. And basically, if somebody accuses you of being Arminian, you go, really, Arminian? I'm not Arminian. I'm Italian. No. Arminian, which means that we believe that we have a role in our salvation in accepting, and that God allows us to decide whether we will be a Christian or not. By the way, there are Arminian groups. the Methodists are Arminian, and the Church of Christ, and even some Baptists. Oh, I wish I could talk about the lead up to Protestantism and the development of evangelicalism and sort of the happy Calvinism of the 18th century and the mourner's bench and the sinner's prayer and all that. I don't have time to talk about that. Hopefully, though, I've given you enough sort of food for thought, and you're going to maybe read some books, and who knows, maybe even get the first three volumes of my church history. Hopefully, volume number four will come out in about a year, year and a half. It's a lot of work, folks. Sorry about that. And it's going to be a fascinating story. Anyway, I wish I could have more time with you, and maybe Steve will arrange maybe a weekend workshop or something like that. But got to go. I think we're going to have a few minutes of question and answer, so I'm going to end the tape here. And I think we're going to do live. When you actually do this thing, I think we're going to have live. I'll be on Zoom, and we can take some questions for a few minutes. I really enjoyed being with you. Thank you for your attention. 31 minutes, Steve.